Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. I'm Andrew Rock. Very welcome to the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce Andrew Rock very briefly. He worked as a stock inspector, as an agricultural economist. He became executive director of the National Farmers Federation and then federal director of the Liberal Party. And in that capacity, he ran the Liberal Party's successful campaign in 1996 under John Howard's leader. He then went into business working for Kerry Packer in the area of database technology. And then from 2004, the member for Goldstein in Melbourne, parliamentary secretary from 2005, and a minister in the Howard government in 2007. And since the election, Andrew Robb has been the shadow finance minister, but he's also chair of the Policy Development Committee. So at both capacities tonight, Andrew Robb's going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic, the broad topic of the Coalition's roadmap for economic policy. Andrew Robb, you're very welcome.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Jared, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Jared very kindly didn't mention that I also ran the 93 Unlosable League. So that's where I got my twitch from, so... But also, could I just acknowledge at the outset the opportunity again? I've had actually five portfolios in 6 years, and with every one, bar one, 2 months in, Jared kindly offered me an opportunity, as he has again 2 months in, to these responsibilities to have my coming out, if you like, or whatever you'd like to call it. But it enabled me to provide a substantive view of, you know, what I thought, what was in my head about the responsibilities. The only one I missed was the climate change. That climate change for about 15 months. And perhaps I missed it because it took me 15 months until the last party room meeting to properly articulate what I thought about that great big new tax. So anyway, I'm here tonight and I appreciate the opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, on the eve of an election after 3 years of governing, the extraordinary thing for me is that people still ask the question of Mr. Rudd, what do you really stand for, and what can you actually deliver? I've never seen this. Someone who is at the centre of things, especially the leader of either party, who after all that time, people have not found what's inside his heart. In this speech tonight, I'd like to contrast the Rudd government's approach and its consequences as opposed to what the Coalition stands for, and the roadmap of real action that we will follow in regaining control of Australia's finances and protecting and growing our economy. There is no sense in the community that the government is in control of things. There's no sense that Mr. Rudd has a plan to protect and grow our economy. In fact, people feel that the government is simply responding to events as they occur, and with a political strategy, not an economic strategy. Australians actually need, I think, a government with the capability and the conviction to deliver on the things that they promise. To this end, the Coalition is determined to offer a clear alternative choice of government to the Australian people. I sense the mood among Australians is one of uncertainty and caution about the future. You can see it already in their spending habits. You saw it 8 months before the crash, actually. Some innate sense of what's coming. Remarkable if you look at what happened to saving numbers 6 or 8 months before Lehman Brothers fell over. As a consequence, I think Australians are looking for leadership. They're looking for calm and sure-footed judgment. And they're looking for a policy roadmap consistent with the uncertainties and the opportunities that we face. The recent wild swings in global equity, bond and currency markets compounds this mood. Australians understand that the major advanced economies of Europe, the US and Japan are deep in debt, without an obvious exit strategy. They know that the global financial woes that bedeviled the world 12 to 18 months ago have not been put to bed. In one sense, they are worse. 18 months ago, the crisis was one of banks and financial institutions. But recently, this has been compounded by the risk of default by Western countries. Yet, the Rudd government's view of the future is confused. One minute, Mr. Rudd's warning that the debt crisis in Europe means Australia is not out of the woods. And the next minute, he's saying that the next commodity price boom has arrived and is here to stay, indefinitely. And sometimes that's in the same answer, in question time. The fact is that the renewed volatility in global financial markets underscores the risk of massive levels of sovereign debt and the fragility of much of the developed world. The response is to urgently rebuild the economic resilience that the Rudd government inherited. If we are to build business and consumer confidence and weather any new worldwide financial crisis, the response is to bring down the debt, embark on a bold productivity-based growth strategy, stop the reckless spending, lock in budget surpluses, rein in the make-work projects which add nothing to productivity growth, and protect the safe haven reputation for global investment that we have enjoyed for around 30 years. The last time we lost it, of course, was in the Whitlam era. We must not forget that events in Europe, in particular in Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy, are in large part due to reform fatigue. As the Economist noted, and I quote, they relaxed and gave up the tiresome business of pushing through reforms to enhance competition, hold down labour costs and boost productivity, end of quote. Mr. Rudd came to office with enormous support for reform. Expectations ran high. There was trust. Yet after 3 years of the Rudd government, I personally despair that the lost opportunity, the cynicism, the incompetence, and the extraordinary growth are put to you of government in our lives. I despair at the loss of international respect, the emergence of major sovereign risk for those who look to invest in Australia, and the mounting cost pressures on those families and the impact these pressures have on their enjoyment of life. Wealth is best created when people and organisations are empowered to maximise their potential, to go with their strengths, to take risks, to take responsibility for their own decisions and actions. Labor does not understand this dynamic. Rather, for them, the government knows best. And if you see a problem, throw money at it, even if it's borrowed. Labor believes that they know how to spend your money better than you do. And for Rudd Labor, all reform revolves around spending money. You think of it. Before the crisis, it was spending money. In the crisis, it was spending money. Post the crisis, it's spending money. All the reform, you look at all the reforms, essentially, that they're proposing, it involves spending money. And if the country's multi-billion dollar surplus and reserves run out, then spend borrowed money and increase taxes. Mr. Rudd has initiated no fundamental reform, much less any unpopular reform, even if that means revealing for all to see that he lacks the courage of his convictions. His promises have proven worthless. The Rudd government harks back to the worst of the Whitlam era, minus the conviction. It is a far cry from the Hawke era, with the likes of Peter Walsh, where the importance of markets and productivity was understood, as was the notion that you don't solve all problems by throwing money at it. Shame about the impulsiveness and pig-headedness of Paul Keating, which delivered the recession we had to have with its 22% interest rates and 1 million unemployed. He lent too hard on some of the levers. The Coalition believes that the Australian community is best served by backing the particular talents and the strengths and decisions of each individual Australian. With this in mind, a Coalition government will shape a secure economic future for Australia around sustainable, strong growth and prudent financial management. High productivity without debt and deficits will provide the foundations of this secure economic future. To this end, the economic roadmap features smaller government with a greater reliance on the private sector and individual initiative and a keen focus on improving the quality of spending, government spending. Secondly, a flexible, fair and internationally competitive tax system for business and individuals with flatter and lower levels of income taxation. A fairer and more flexible workplace where real wage increases can be expected. We saw 22% real wage increases through the 11 and a half years of the Howard government. We saw minus 1.2% through the 16 years of the Hawke-Keating governments. It's going to repeat itself. The cost price pressures that people are confronting because they're not getting wage increases, but interest rates are going up, prices are going up. The expectation was that they would get wage increases given the campaign that was run by the Rudd government. More expectations. We will have another feature of world-class education, training and health services where excellence and efficiency is rewarded and greater local control is achieved. We'll have a compassionate welfare system where personal responsibility is encouraged and expected. We'll have a sustainable population involving a plan for immigration and growth which values and enhances individual quality of life. We'll look to have flexible energy, water, transport and telecommunications markets, not a renationalisation of telecommunications. We'll have improved efficiency of existing infrastructure, including social infrastructure, aged care, hospitals, etc., plus new infrastructure based on publicly available benefit-cost analyses. Not possible, it seems, under this government, though they promised it. Sustainable water use, a more competitive financial sector with particular focus on small business. Improved housing affordability, where land release is encouraged and other investments are made more attractive. A major focus on Indigenous education and work opportunities without paternalism. A sustainable and clean environment where research and rehabilitation of soils and other is prominent. Less regulation with a priority attack on excessive reporting requirements. We'll have a real attack, you'll see it in our campaign, on excessive reporting requirements. More effective federal-state relations with a return to the competition policy model applied to a range of policy objectives. And finally, we'll be playing to our strengths by further reinforcing areas of comparative advantage. Playing to our strengths mean, among other things, not overtaxing industries where we have comparative advantage compared with our overseas competitors. I had close involvement at the National Farmers Federation with one of the decades, over the many decades of the last century, where as a country we overtaxed industries such as mining and agriculture and other successful export and import competing industries through a wall of manufacturing tariffs which significantly increased the cost of so many inputs. It took years to educate and reverse that anomaly. The Rudd government is now reverting back to this long discredited practice of overtaxing a major area of comparative advantage, the mining sector, all off the back of a class warfare context. It is a great folly to return to a policy approach which reduces competitiveness, kills investment and jobs, and undermines the great strengths with which Australia is blessed. Reviewing the 3 years of the Rudd government experiment tells us much about what we must do to turn around the mess of debt and deficits. Before the global recession, monetary policy in the form of interest rates was typically used to increase or discourage consumer and business spending as necessary, both here and overseas. Government spending or fiscal policy was primarily focused on incentives, savings and funding government services. Following the arrival of the financial crisis, lowering interest rates to stimulate spending was not an option for many OECD countries because their huge public debts and meant that interest rates in most of those countries, the US and others, were close to zero, if not at zero. They'd already tried that over several years to fire up their economies. And most households as well in those countries have traditionally fixed interest rate mortgages, as distinct from here, which we mainly have variable interest rate mortgages. And so for this reason, because they couldn't do anything with monetary policy, lower interest rates, the Northern Hemisphere governments were forced to massively increase public spending if they wanted to stimulate the economy and soften the impact of the recession. And of course we've seen trillion dollar debts and deficits resulting in the Northern Hemisphere. In my view, the Rudd government panicked and overreacted by mimicking this high-spending Northern Hemisphere solution. Rubbing shoulders with the Northern Hemisphere big boys clouded their judgment. They spent more time over there than they did here, looking for the solution. And in my view, they were consumed with what was going on there. Their judgment was clouded, that of Mr. Rudd and Mr. Swan. They were blinkered and failed to see the alternative Australian solution. They rushed into it, they panicked, and they, in fact, a few days ahead of OEC, knowing what was going to happen, brought out the initiatives that they embarked on. Unlike the Northern Hemisphere, though, Australia entered the global financial crisis with no public debt, a $20 billion surplus, $45 billion in the bank, a record low 4% unemployment, a strong pipeline of projects, construction projects, both big and smaller ones, housing, etc., and a properly regulated financial sector. Alternative solutions were possible and far more appropriate in Australia. And in Australia, the automatic economic stabilisers kicked in. The exchange rate dropped from 90 cents to the US dollar to 60 cents to the US dollar. This proved a massive aid to exports, prompting Australia's largest ever trade surplus in the first quarter of 2009, largest ever. And my years running the National Farmers Federation, we would be involved in all the interest rates and tariffs and other issues. And I can tell you, a 5% movement in exchange rate overwhelmed any of those other issues in terms of the economic impact on the sector, either up or down. So this stabiliser moved in. We had massive increase in revenue. Massive. Highest trade surplus ever in our history. Now, you combine that with the prevalence of variable mortgage rates in Australia, rather than the overseas fixed mortgage rates, and interest rates that could be lowered, and it meant that interest rates flowed straight through to people's pockets, straight through their variable interest rate on their mortgage. So we had a progressive reduction of interest rates by 4.25%, and it saw immediate and very significant injections of cash into millions of households, and no scope for waste and mismanagement. No scope for a bunch of bureaucrats to get hold of a program that they're not skilled in managing. No scope for fires and deaths and all the rest of it. Straight through the tax system, straight through the interest rate system, I mean, and into their pockets. So combined with long-standing effective banking regulations and a very strong mining sector, both in the lead-up to and during the downturn, notwithstanding what others say, these measures in combination with some of the first $10 billion of fiscal stimulus, which was backed by the Coalition, ensured Australia had a soft landing. To me, they were the things. The $42 billion second tranche of stimulus money in 2009 was an unnecessary overreaction, which saw debt and spending expand rapidly, making it very difficult to wind back deficits and putting very strong upward pressure on interest rates. It's no coincidence we've got the highest interest rates in the OECD. No coincidence whatsoever. The reckless spending continues today, putting major pressure on interest rates and leading to 6 interest rate rises in a row. If we'd had much less spending, interest rates would be lower now. And so, in the day in the Parliament, before I left, Swan's up there with the National Accounts today, proudly saying that public spending underpinned, if you look at the National Accounts, the first quarter results, because, you know, most of the 0.5% growth came out of public spending. Well, it has to, because interest rates have gone up dramatically 6 times in the last 12 months because of the high public spending. If they hadn't had the high public spending, interest rates would be lower, more money flowing through into, in fact, a lot of money, you know, many hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into pockets, much more, I suspect, than what we're seeing through the spending. And we have the ludicrous situation where fiscal policy is at loggerheads with monetary policy. One stimulating the economy and crowding out private investment and causing interest rates to go up, while the other puts the brakes on the high interest rates. Now, this is a ludicrous situation to have these two arms of policy working against one another. Australia's now paying the price. It's why we've got a $57 billion deficit in this year, which was not mentioned hardly at all the other night in the budget by the Treasurer. He kept talking about several years out what was going to happen. It's why we've got a debt approaching $130 billion when you add in what they're going to borrow for the broadband program. It's why we're going to be borrowing $700 million a week for the next 2 years. $700 million the government will be borrowing in competition with small business and other business and homeowners for those funds. And that's why we've got a multi-million dollar interest repayment for years to come, 6 interest rate rises in a row, and greater vulnerability for all of us if the world experiences a double dip recession. Households who took out a typical mortgage last year are now paying $4,000 to $5,000 per year in loan repayments, resulting in enormous cost of living increases. That's about, $8,000 or $9,000 before tax they've got to earn to pay the extra in interest rate charges. This reckless spending, a response to one quarter of negative growth in the December quarter of 2008, is programmed now to continue until 2012, 4 years after the global financial crisis. It makes absolutely no sense. This spending has been accompanied by the greatest growth of government in our lives since the disastrous Whitlam era. Despite Kevin Rudd coming to power as a self-proclaimed fiscal conservative, championing risk and enterprise and lower taxes, the Rudd government used the world recession as a Trojan horse to push an old-style Labor interventionist agenda. To be the only country in the world to re-regulate its labour market in the midst of a financial crisis. To be the only country I know that is renationalising its telecommunications sector through the $43 billion broadband proposal, for which there's still no business plan. To design an emissions trading scheme, which I know only too well, which maximised government revenue and maximised government involvement in investment decisions, crawling all over those 1,000 companies that were to be a part of it, rather than leaving company balance sheets strong enough to invest in low emissions technology. An intervention is an agenda which further undermines private health insurance, where they seek to dismantle employee share ownership. They lost that battle. To kill competition in the financial markets that had taken nearly 30 years to build. To seek to establish a government bank, the Rudd Bank, which is another battle they lost. And to limit choices of our kids and grandchildren as they pay taxes for decades to repay the hundreds of billions of dollars of Commonwealth and guaranteed Commonwealth state debt, as well as entering into the so-called passive partnership in every mining project in the country through the imposition of a great big new mining tax. Along the way, in seeking to introduce this agenda of taxing and spending, borrowing and government intervention, the Rudd government has established a reputation as an incompetent administration after the monumental mismanagement of the $2.4 billion home insulation fiasco, the $6 to $8 billion wasted in delivering the 16.2 school hall program, the $1.2 billion blowout with the computer and schools program, the extra $1 billion price tag from the failure to control our borders and stop boats coming, the embarrassing Indigenous housing program, the broken promises over the emissions trading scheme, private health insurance, childcare, GP super clinics, broadband, political advertising by the government, tax hikes on employer superannuation, and a huge new tax that will make our resources sector the highest tax resources sector in the world by a country mile. You can see this is, if it wasn't so serious, it'd be a joke. Just look, that's 2.5 years of effort. The huge interventionist agenda, which will take, I think, urgently needs to be started to be wound back. If we get another 3 or 6 years, that will be locked in, so much of that. The Deputy Prime Minister has just authorised the spending of a further $5.5 billion, oblivious to all this, for the next phase of the Building the Education Revolution stimulus program, despite promising to wait and consider a $14 million investigation she commissioned herself into this chronically wasteful and discredited program. It's the spin and the cynicism is palpable. I mean, all that stuff, spend $14 million, have a commission of inquiry into this, appoint the person, then go and spend all the rest of the money before they report, an urgent report. I mean, they get away with it. The coalition government will tackle the debt and deficits head on and stop the reckless spending. Already we have announced $22 billion of capital account savings, which will come straight off the Rudd government's protected debt. In addition, we've announced detailed cuts to 39 Rudd government spending programs, totaling $24.7 billion. It's an unprecedented election commitment, by a country mile. Significant additional cuts have been identified, and we will be announcing those ahead of the election. In addition to better quality spending, the cuts will see a multi-billion dollar reduction over the forward estimates and hasten real, not imagined, progress in getting the books back in the black. To this end, we must not squander the financial benefits that will flow from the demand from China in the immediate future. We've got to capitalise on that in the next year, 2-3 years. We must not be lulled into adopting what I see as a naive Rudd government assumption on which the budget was based, that the commodities boom will continue indefinitely and predicted to last for decades. A commodities boom will have a limited future if we face a world experiencing another major loss of financial confidence and a flight from risk. Furthermore, 18 years of professional involvement in agriculture exposed me to many commodity booms and busts. Almost always, the booms tapered off much sooner than expected. Invariably, forecasters and industry members badly underestimated the size and speed of the worldwide supply response to surging commodity prices. Again and again, I saw this happen. The same is happening now in the resources sector. The world is awash with mineral resources. If you talk to people in the industry, thousands of projects are on the drawing boards in Eastern Europe and Asia and North America and South America and Africa. There is a 4 or 5 year window, in my view, and I worked for several years in the resources sector, in which to capture many new resource projects that will benefit Australia for 30 or 40 or 50 years. If we don't capture this opportunity in the next 2 or 3 years, we will have missed the boat, and future generations of Australians will be much the poorer for it. It is why the Rudd government's introduction of a deeply flawed and erroneous 40% resources rent tax in the middle of all this is so stupid. The proposal and the manner in which it has been announced puts this investment at risk. It is why Australians no longer believe that the Rudd government has the right answers or the courage to see them through. People aren't believing. As this campaign goes on, you can see it by the day, people are starting to see that their own self-interest, despite all the class war rhetoric, is at stake here. The Rudd government's panic response to the financial crisis had another long-term adverse consequence: the destruction of much of the competition in the banking sector built up over nearly 30 years. The small business sector has suffered most. The taxpayer-funded bank guarantee, designed to secure credit supply and reduce the borrowing costs of the banks, was not passed on to consumers, despite having perhaps the lowest cost guarantee among the OECD countries at 70 basis points. Banking analysts estimate that of the 4.25% reduction in interest rates that occurred from 3rd of September 2008, around 3.8% was passed on to home loans, yet 2% or less was passed on to small business and farmers. In the middle of a financial crisis, we saw the four big banks not only secure much greater market share through mergers and acquisitions and the flight of deposits, but also make record profits. During this time, the banks chased the home mortgage market while neglecting lending to businesses. In particular, the bar was raised for small business, with a significant hike in risk premiums and a marked reduction in credit availability and length of loans. In many cases, a lot of the small and medium business financing, which often came out of trust funds that had been there for 50 years, the deposit guarantee sucked all that money out. A lot of those had gone. The avenue and the traditional competition for small business loans was lost, and it was left to the banks to provide that. And of course, they've got options, and they did have a marked reduction in the credit availability and length of loans, and it goes on. But from my point of view, banks work for their shareholders. So given the opportunity, the banks use the government guarantees to minimise their risk, maximise market share and maximise profits. Totally rational thing and responsible thing for the banks to do in that situation. But the failure was the Rudd government's. The government was intimidated, in my view, by the big four banks. The taxpayer-funded guarantee should have come with conditions attached to ensure that business, especially small business, shared properly in the benefits of the guarantees. Higher productivity is a foundation on which debt and deficits will be eliminated. And given that the small business sector is the engine room of innovation in Australia, in fact, I think a lot of big business really outsources innovation to small business. Quite a logical thing. I certainly saw it in the mining sector again and again. But from a productivity and employment point of view, if it is the engine room of much innovation, it should have particular attention, especially in what we've been through, in protecting these productive assets. And in fact, the reverse happened. And what we saw was a housing boom at the end of a financial crisis. It sort of beggars belief, really. As well as cutting the size of government to reduce the crowding out of small business seeking finance, the Coalition is exploring additional ways in which the continuing squeeze on credit can be addressed by the banks and others, as well as opportunities to restore more competition into what is now one of the most concentrated banking markets in the world. A little bit conscious of the time, I've got one more topic I want to cover, if I could, and then we'll have some questions. The government's so-called super profits tax on the resources sector, in my view, is a bugger's muddle. Each day brings forward a new unintended consequence, confirming our little thought went into the consequences of the tax. It's a great big tax grab to pay for reckless spending and continued reckless spending. It's not a tax reform. I think it was conceived in haste for that reason. Try and balance their books some, you know, 3, 4, 5 years out and make up a story which they will seek to sell to get through an election. A decade ago, when the Howard government introduced the GST, at the same time reducing income tax and abolishing a whole raft of inefficient taxes, the catch cry was, it's not a new tax, it's a new system. Well, this is not a new tax system, it's just a great big new tax. The tax will increase the retail price of gas and electricity. When you increase the cost of producing energy, someone will have to pay. No doubt it is the end user. This sort of debate going on, is, I can't understand it. The superannuation savings of millions of Australians will be significantly affected, and all to pay for the government's reckless spending. One thing I did observe working on farms in my teens, even before studying economics, was that when the profits from producing wheat or sheep or beef went down significantly, farmers produced less of that product and moved to producing more of something else, which gave them greater returns. In a similar vein, I would have thought that if the returns from producing minerals in Australia went down significantly because of a 40% tax on profits, then companies would be inclined to set up new mines in other countries where returns for the same generic commodity were much higher and where the rules didn't change midstream without consultation at the whim of an ignorant government. No matter what the theoretical models say with their assumptions of perfect capital markets and guaranteed growth, the real world doesn't work this way. The tax will see dozens of future new mining projects shelved, billions of dollars of investment, and tens of thousands of jobs will go elsewhere in the world. Before standing for Parliament in 2004, one commercial project I was involved with was 2 years as a member of one of Chevron's investment teams on the Gorgon gas project, the huge gas field off the North West Shelf. One of the many things I learned was the existence of many Chevron investment teams running a similar ruler over similar projects in the four corners of the globe. Our competition were other investment teams within the same company. It was intense. It was like almost Labor Liberal in terms of your, the way in which you were fighting to get your project up. A 15% return on investment was merely the starting gate of getting your project ahead of many others of these projects all around the world. My abiding conclusion was that these big resource companies have options, and many of them. As well, the competitive position of each project was extremely sensitive to relevant taxation positions between countries. And I remember in putting a proposition, that was one of two investment teams. One was to look at turning the gas into clean diesel, this was the team I was on, and another one to send it off as LNG. And I remember we got a major consideration from the Howard government. Would have provided 80 years of 35% of all of our transport fuel needs with clean diesel. It's unbelievable from all sorts of points of view. And it looked on paper better than the LNG. And O'Reilly, who ran the company until a few months ago, in considering this, said, what about the sovereign risk? I said, it's Australia, no sovereign risk. He said, Andrew, I make money in Africa with dictatorships. We do strike a contract, and we can guarantee it in most cases. He said, my trouble is with the democracies. And I said, what about the condensate consideration of the North West Shelf? 28 years that it run, and it was $2 billion a year. Consideration was part of the whole deal at the origin to set up the North West Shelf, which is how much has that brought to Australia? And it's extraordinary. And he said, OK, I hear that. Anyway, decide against it. Because largely of sovereign risk. 5 years later, We've been through government for 3 years. I've been in opposition. It's 2 years after I got into the parliament and all the rest. And what did the Labor Party do? The first thing in the first budget, they removed the condensate consideration, which no one understands, but the industry does. Sovereign risk. O'Reilly was right. O'Reilly was right. Okay. So, and now looks a bit large. And my friends in New York and other places around the world in the financial investment market, they're beside themselves. They're trying to can't place, not just in mining stocks, but in every other thing in Australia. More going to be more difficult, more costly to place money if they think there's this prospect of the rules being changed midstream. The Rudd government, in my view, is playing with fire. Bank finance will be further discouraged because they value the loss reimbursement component of the tax, where the government's going to take 40% of the losses. They value that at zero. I think if the government can make these changes, 10 years' time, if a mine goes bust, how do we know that they're going to stay with that commitment? So they value it at zero. I was at the at a stall, a little mine, the stall gift. It's a town of 6,000 people in rural Victoria. There's a mine there, you never see it when you drive past, but it pumps $55 million into the local region. But it's only a little gold mine. I mean, it's not big in the scheme of things. And I went there last week, and the Canadians support it, and they explore every 2 or 3 years to find a new seam of gold, because it's a lot of folding took place millions of years ago, and they know it's there, but they don't necessarily know where it is. So they have to spend $20 million every 2 or 3 years to find more gold to run it for another 2 or 3 years. The head office had just signed off on $21 million. They'd gone over, he went overseas, the MD got back the day I arrived. He said they're beside themselves. They're absolutely certain that this mine won't be financed to $21 million. They'll be closed in 6 years. The $55 million, which really underpins the local economy, will be gone. It's the finance. It's not the tax. They never make 5%. So they only make around 5%. So they're not going to get hit with the tax. They're going to get hit with no finance. And these are things, if you don't understand how business works and how that sector works, and Rudd hasn't got a clue, he's making decisions on the run for political purposes and overlooking the consultation that should have taken place, the consideration, found out about how the 4,200 mines that are out there, and it's not just Rio and BHP, there are 4,200 registered mining companies. All of these little mines and quarries and local opal mines and gravel quarries around local towns, all of these will be hit with the tax, or they won't have access to the finance, or both. It covers much of what I was going to say, I think, on this, except all this nonsense about what is a fair return, what's a fair share. That's all we hear, because we know their research and what works for them. At the moment, the mining industry appraisal was confirmed with KPMG work overnight, and KPMG did the government's work with the government's assumptions. But without the government's assumptions of guaranteed growth at the end of this tax and all the rest, you get some real world results. It confirmed that the mining industry is paying about 40% effective rate of tax. All other companies are paying 30, 29, 20, 28. On average. That means the mining sector is paying 33% more tax than all other companies in Australia when you count the royalties and all the rest. It is, in my view, paying a fair share. 33% more tax than everyone else year in, year out, in my view, is a fair share for the fact they've got a finite resource that they're using, etc. What the government is proposing is to take that 40% up to 55%, again confirmed in the KPMG work. That's an 85% increase over every other company in Australia, the banks, everybody else. Now, to me, that is not a fair share. That's just a money grab, and one with got severe consequences for our sovereign risk, our reputation, and for the bottom line with all of these deals. Trying to get an ROI of 15% with an 85% tax, well, what amounts to 60%, 58, 60% tax, to me, is ridiculous. In conclusion, Ronald Reagan said government's view of the economy could be summed up in a few short phrases. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidise it. I suggest Kevin Rudd's approach could be summed up even more simply. If money has been saved, spend it. If an industry is profitable and successful, tax it. If it questions or opposes you, vilify it. Okay? This is not reform. It is governed by the news cycle. We need a government that makes decisions. Mr Rudd has yet to make a hard decision. He can't be seen over his groaning to do this, in my view. He's all talk, he's no action. The next 12 months are critical, and the next 3 years are absolutely critical. What if Australia has another 3 years like the last? Australia needs clear policies. We need to build the self-reliance that we had when Mr Rudd inherited the economy. And we need people who can say no. I think a word foreign to Mr Rudd, and Mr Swan and Mr Tanner. We have a plan, we have a roadmap, those 16 points I raised and the way in which we will approach them. Our policies, as we announce them, will reflect that approach. And we've got, I think, the people who've got the strength to do the job. I think if Australia supports that plan, we will see any future challenges, we'll see them through, and we'll make the most of the wonderful opportunities Australia presents. You make your own luck. Thank you.
Many thanks to Mr. Rudd. Thanks also to Clay for the use of this facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, so we have some brief questions and some brief answers, and everyone will be happy. There's a question over there. Yep.
Yes, Chris Dulles. What I don't understand is if you look at running about 3% growth and 5% unemployment, the last time we were in Australia's that position was 2006, we had a $17 billion surplus. We now have a 40. I thought it was 40. Now you thought it was 57. It's more scary. I can't understand why the media isn't picking up on this. I mean, this is an economic disaster. You're portraying as a disaster, but why isn't the media picking up on this?
I think in the main, they backed the change, but it's always difficult to acknowledge that you made a mistake. I think things have changed somewhat in the last 2 or 3 months. Not so much in the critique about what, the outcome of it, but in the way they've done it, the backflips by Rudd. The expectations have been so dramatically sort of squashed. In the first year of office, they had 173 committees. And a lot of those, there was millions of man hours spent by lots of people all over the country thinking at last some of our issues are going to be dealt with. There's reports sitting on shelves, by the dozens, with people's expectations just being totally ignored, and the cynicism is palpable. And it's, and the same with the economy. They keep doing things like they've got this, we'll have a surplus in 3 years' time. It's a house of cards. It's a nonsense. The assumptions they've made to get there are so heroic. It's just ridiculous. And so I think a lot of people don't understand it. In my view, it's quite clear we had alternative approaches to take. It is that spending. It is that 57 million. If they hadn't spent the second surplus, the second stimulus, they'd be well within reach of getting close to removing the deficit. And they didn't need it, in my view. They've actually worked against it. And the reason we've got 5%, they've bought a lot of this employment. And they're proudly saying they've kept people in jobs. But I think they would have stayed in jobs anyway, because lower interest rates would have kept the economy going. And we wouldn't have the debt and deficit. So I think people are starting to wake up, notwithstanding, your concern. I think it's starting to cut through that this fellow has got no plan. He can't make decisions. He can't do things. He's like the handyman, in my view, that we all know. He starts 100 jobs and finishes another.
Just on the issue of your roadmap, I think it's fair to say the Howard government had a pretty good record on the economy, but there's one area where it seemed to me that the Howard government didn't succeed, which was the promise to cut red tape in half, and it didn't do it. Now, tonight, in your roadmap, you're talking about reducing this. I mean, how are you going to do under Tony Abbott what John Howard couldn't do in 10 years of substantially reducing government regulation?
Well, as I've looked on that, I've got policy, chairman of the Policy Development Committee, it's been a great opportunity to go into all sorts of areas. As I get into childcare, as I get into job networks, as I get into so many areas of activity where the private sector is doing a lot of the work, the accumulation of regulations and reporting requirements is just unbelievable. I was at a childcare centre the other day, and after every child did anything, they moved a motion, or they they burped or they, you know, said something inspiring at 9 months of age, people had to write it down so that they could report to the parents and send that report. It was unbelievable, the amount of paperwork. So this is, this will happen with this new tax on mining. If the government has to have 40% risk, you know, if I was a finance minister and I'm facing the prospect of billions of dollars of taxpayers' money being at risk with failed mining options, I'm not going to be passive. I'd be irresponsible to be passive. This is nonsense that they'll be passive. They'll be crawling all over companies, and what they'll do is have mountains of reporting requirements. Now, I've seen in so many areas, like when the Howard government gave responsibility for running a lot of the welfare services to welfare organisations, we saw enormous efficiency gains for about 4 or 5 years. And then the public servants who wanted to make sure their backside was covered started to introduce reporting requirements, right? And we could cut out, I tell you, big licks of all of that reporting just overnight, and it would not make one bit of difference to outcomes, and it would save, you know, millions of dollars for a lot of these services. So we are looking, as I said in the speech, in reporting requirements as the first. I think we can save many, many millions of dollars, and a lot of these were built up after good work by the Howard government, slowly but surely, public servants saying, well, I think if we had this data and that data and whatever, we could make sure that, because no one wants to take any blame these days.
So there's a question in the middle there, yes, and then we go down there. Yes?
Hi, thanks for your talk, Mr. Rob. I guess it kind of ties in with the question that Dura asked. Obviously, the majority of the people in Australia wanted a change in government when Labour came to power, and I was wondering if Liberal has, a vision of lessons learned from the Howard years and how they would, what they would do differently when they come to power now as a vision for the people of Australia. So not so much going into the actual subject matter.
Yes, okay. Well, I think policies always move on. I think when we governed best in the Howard years, and I only had 3 years at the end, but when we governed best was when we were staying true to our principles. You know, choice, the growth of independent schools to give people choice, the growth of private health to give people choice. 56% of all operations are now conducted in the private sector. And it relieves the pressure on public hospitals so you can finance them to do what they should do. So I think the areas where we governed best was we stayed true to our principles. So really, I sought to go back to what is our train tracks, you know, what are the things. Labor, I can see, usually it takes three or four turns at least before slowly but surely the sort of interventionist instinct of Labor, and that is, it's a legitimate instinct, but it's the wrong one, I think, but for that to emerge. But they've used the financial crisis, I think, as a stalking horse, as a Trojan horse, to bring in all of this. And it has confirmed for me that how quickly things can change. You know, 3 years, Gough Whitlam, the 3 years of Gough Whitlam took 20 years to fix. Governments can make a mess in 3 years. And so it's, have we learned lessons? Yes. But I think, you know, there's a lot that if we could mimic John Howard's approach, we would be doing the country a big service. But a lot of it, I think, is actually doing things, taking decisions. You know, in business, even at home, whatever, nothing happens unless you push it, unless you make a decision. And you'll make mistakes, but unless you make decisions, nothing happens. This government has not made decisions. He runs away at the end, and it's all, you know, it's all for the cameras, but it's not about governing, and you'll be punished for it.
Question just behind, yeah. There.
You say that Kevin Rudd is a politician that doesn't stand for anything, but I'm looking at the Liberal Party over the last 6 months, and you keep saying great big new tax, but Tony Abbott's parental leave is also a great big new tax. And I saw Tony Abbott say that climate change is absolute crap, and then I see Joe Bockie on Insider saying that the Liberal Party is the only party with a policy on climate change. But I'm confused because I thought it was absolute crap. And then, again...
Okay, I got the bit. He didn't say that climate change was an absolute crap. I don't think he knows. I don't think most people know, frankly. You know, they don't know the science. I've looked at it for years, and I can give you so much variation going on out there, I can give you a set of numbers to support their side of the argument. But he didn't. He said that the emissions trading scheme was crap, and it was. I'm telling you, it was a great big new tax, and it would have imposed an enormous burden on this community and killed our competitive position again, just like this mining tax is sort of going for those things that we're good at. But it wouldn't have done anything for the environment. It would have sent CO2 emission production offshore to less efficient areas. It takes zinc production in Australia, 2.6 tonnes of zinc, of CO2 we produce for every tonne of zinc, go to China, 6.4 tonnes of CO2 emissions for every tonne of zinc. So what I'm saying is, okay, the inconsistency, I'm saying, irrespective of, we have got a set of principles which we will and have been designing our policies around. They are, you know, to support the individual, make the most of the talents that we've all got, and give people freedom, and the price of that is to take responsibility for their actions. And if, in our view is, you maximise those opportunities, you do the best for the community, not have government involved in so many areas of our life making all the decisions for us.
There's a question down there.
Yes, I was just wondering whether you might be throwing the baby out of the bathwater on this super tax, you know, like it seems that some elements that can be modified that might lead to $9 billion being accrued each year, like South Africans have introduced a modified royalties tax, I think, last week or week before. So is there no room for any improvement on that area? I think it would be a political advantage for you if there was some improvement.
Well, this is what Rudd wants. He wants us to concede. If you thought the tax was all about good design, well, and if it was all about reform, one, you would have thought he would have consulted the industry.
Sure.
Two, he wouldn't have vilified them from the outset, right? Three, he wouldn't have started to set up what we haven't seen for 40 years, the sort of class warfare sort of approach. In my view, this was not designed to be tax reform. We have got a resource rent tax in gas. Well, you know, he could have started with that. He could have just started at that level, but it doesn't produce the revenue. That one didn't have retrospective. This one has. They want the revenue. They're not interested in. I mean, Ken Henry might have been interested in the reform. If they brought in this profits tax, and set it at the level of current royalties, there wouldn't have been any debate. It's $9 billion a year more. It is totally a tax grab. It is poorly designed because they haven't consulted with the industry. They put it in their forward estimates. This is what got the industry back up from day one. How can we have a negotiation over something that we were deceived about, you know, the intention of, they always thought they'd be consulted. They'd said they wanted this form of tax to replace royalties. The industry said it. They're still saying it. But only at that level, not at a level that's going to, as I say, attack one of our greatest comparative advantages. We are going back to the tariff war era again, and it's, you know, ironically, it's a Labor government when Hawke, you know, reversed all that.
Final question, Lindsay.
I just wanted to ask you what you think of Ken Henry's performance over the last 6 months, or 6 weeks, or 6 minutes.
Well, as Tony Abbott said, our fight's not with Ken. So, if I can say that in a diplomatic way, maybe you can read something into that.
That was a good interpretation. Yeah.
What's your view of the wisdom of taking tax receipts generated from the exploitation of a finite resource, like fossil fuels or stuff we dig out of the ground, and putting it into a sovereign wealth fund of the type that we keep hearing about so successful in Norway?
Yeah, well, again, there's misinformation. The Norway company is government-owned. They say there's a 95% tax. You know, they're paying 5% for bonds, and the rest of the 95% goes in the government coffers. So we all sit here, hear this from the Prime Minister's mouth about in Norway, they take it and put it in a sovereign fund. If they want to nationalise the industry, fine, we can put it all into a sovereign fund. But first and foremost, I think there is a case for having the industry pay a bigger share. And I think 33% more than every other company in Australia is not a bad thing, given the all those things are worthless until someone puts some serious money and risk into it, right? So you've got to give them a return. Now, we were at the highest level with America and with Brazil in the world. To go above that, you're starting to tax your comparative advantage. To go seriously above that, you know, it's stupidity in the extreme. In my view, you know, at that level, we're probably not making enough to put into sovereign funds, etc. So I don't think it's a... it's not a bad sort of concept. We put 60 billion into the future fund. That's a sovereign fund. It's one of the biggest in the world. Okay, so we've done it when we had surplus monies and tax from the mining sector. It's what gave us... They gave us, in the end, you know, the 20 million surplus and the 45 million net savings in banks and 4% unemployment and all the rest. So in a way, we did invest it back in the economy and then we did put it into sovereign funds. So it's maybe got a place, but I prefer to give as much as you can back into productive activities. I mean, if you into encouraging infrastructure and doing things with that money to build future generation of income.
Many thanks. Take a seat. Great to have Andrew Robb back at the Sydney Institute, and thanks for an important comment tonight. There's no doubt the return of Mr. Robb to the front bench has given a lot of intellectual clout and economic knowledge to the coalition. We've seen evidence of that tonight. So I'm pleased that you've given your first major speech as Shadow Finance Minister to us here tonight and set out the roadmap which the coalition will be following over the next few months up to the election. So we're very pleased, and no doubt after the election we'll have you back again. But for tonight, well done. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.